All right, here we go. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and for the last time this season, welcome to CCNA Discovery 1. This is Module 9, Troubleshooting. My name's Elise Lonsdale, and the usual question, how you going, Magic Jay?
Oh, if I was any better, I'd have to be twins and the world couldn't stand it.
Well, I'm going to be really good in 3 days. Three sleeps to go. Guess what I do, everybody out there in listening land? I go to the US of A, and we get to meet Jackie. So, without further ado, I think it's time for a little bit of indulgence, don't you, Jay?
10-4, but we need to tell them why. We need to tell them why.
Somebody's decided to pass their Discovery 1 course, and it's a big congratulations to Kylie Maloney.
I'm done with my teaching. Get me out from the bed. Don't need any clip notes. No more looking to glass. I'm officially history. You can kiss my ass. I'm
congratulations, Kylie. Congratulations.
Congratulations, Kylie.
Ditto, congratulations.
Yep, she achieved a very good score, and her work in the worksheets was very diligent. She has some wonderful researching skills.
And Kylie's not even here.
Is she gone?
Yeah, she is.
Yeah, she's not responding. Maybe she's all blushing. You 35 shades of red yet, hon?
Maybe she had to go put her groceries away.
Sorry, guys, the groceries arrived in the middle of all that.
Oh, good on. We were just
you
congratulating
you. Missed your graduation song.
No, I heard it. It's okay. I had to tell the guy what was happening because I've got the speakers on. Hang on. I'll just go and get the frozens off the floor. Hang on a minute.
Sure. Well, it's the last day. We can muck up a bit because we don't have time for a separate muck-up session like we did last semester, do we, Jay?
No, because we're not going to muck up over here. We're going to be mucking up, but not with Cavi.
Yeah, Phoenix will never be the same again. Hey, gang, any questions?
I have one. Did y'all learn anything?
Yeah.
Why, yeah.
Gary's learned something. What did you learn, Gary?
Or overstay away from Phoenix for a while.
Oh, good on you. Good on you.
Says stay away from Phoenix for a while.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, yeah. Don't be coming over to Phoenix for a while. It's going to be in flux and turbulence.
It's going to be a nightmare for 3 weeks. 3 whole weeks. And yes, we are going to go to the Grand Canyon. So your poor delivery man must have been really stressing when he walked in and delivered your shopping, Kylie. What lunatic asylum have I walked into here?
Something like that. Nah, he was pretty good, actually.
So your cavy crazy house. Murray, have you learned anything? Oh, sorry. Go, Jay.
No, go ahead.
A little bit of quick.
Yeah, I picked up a few things. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Who else is on the channel here?
What about you, Joe? You learned anything?
Well, I'll tell you what Joe needs to learn. He needs to how to fix that cratering internet connection he's got, I think. There you go. He's gone. A practical application of Discovery already, Joe. Go fix it.
All right, guys. Well, I guess we better get rolling along, but we wanted to congratulate Kylie on her graduation.
Yeah. Who was doing the introduction? You're doing the odds.
So you're doing the introduction.
In this chapter, you will learn how to troubleshoot network failures. So that's a pretty good thing. I had to do that the other night. Recognize and correct the common causes of network problems. After completion of this chapter, you should be able to describe the troubleshooting process. Describe the utilities to verify TCP/IP connectivity. Describe the identify common hardware connections and wired and wireless connections. And use the troubleshooting process to document problems and interact with the help desk. Jay, you're up.
I'm up. Okay. Well, troubleshooting is obviously the process of recognizing, identifying, and locating, and then hopefully fixing problems that occur on the network. They make a statement in your notes that experienced individuals often rely on instinct to troubleshoot. Yeah. I wouldn't call it instinct exactly. I would call it, you know, when you've seen similar things over and over again, after a while you kind of, you know, learn things. There are, however, some structured techniques that can be used, and these are especially helpful to people who are not as experienced. Whether or not the person is experienced, though, proper documentation should always be kept. There is absolutely nothing more frustrating that I know of that you troubleshoot something, you get in a hurry, you forget to write it down, and then a year later you're faced with it and you say, ah, man, I remember having to deal with that problem. What the fire truck did I do to fix it? Now, that's frustrating. So, it should include as much information as possible. And what should be documented is the problem encountered, steps taken to determine the cause of the problem, and steps to fix the cause of the problem and ensure that it won't reoccur. Definitely document all steps in troubleshooting. You would think that documenting the things that did not solve the issue shouldn't be done, but actually it should be done, and it's a very important thing to do. So that you, if you happen to be fixing the problem the next time, or another technician, don't have to rehash old stuff. So let's discuss the troubleshooting process a little bit. The first thing that you're going to do is that you're going to gather information. Usually what happens is that a problem is reported to you. And so the first thing that you want to do is, once that happens, is that you want to verify it, and you want to determine the extent of the problem. In other words, if I'm working at an office and a user calls me and says, my machine won't connect to the network, one of the first questions I'm going to ask that user is, hey, what about your neighbors around you? Are they connected? Could you check with them for a minute and see if they're connected? Because that's going to tell me if the problem is with their machine specifically, or if it might be with a particular part of the network as a whole. The other thing that you need to do is confirm the problem. So, like today, Elise and I were troubleshooting something on a website, and I said, send me this URL that you say can't be found. And so she sent me the URL, and I clicked on it, and it said the same thing. Whoa, it can't be found. So that was confirmation, in fact, that a problem existed. Not that I didn't believe her, because I did. But sometimes you want to confirm that a particular problem, you know, does in fact exist if you can.
And so to say it for yourself. So,
well, yeah. Plus, I just wanted the URL anyway. So, one of the ways that you're going to gather information is to obviously... Hold on a second, guys.
There goes the doorbell. So not only does Kylie get visitors during the day, I wonder if it's my one of my parcels I sent there. Right, I should have been following Jackie in the notes. But essentially, yeah, what Jackie was saying is that sometimes it's good just to verify the problem, and you get the user to send you the link if it's a broken link. But back in the realms of networking, we were doing web development before class, aren't we, multitasking people? Yeah, you might want to ask them sort of the right sort of questions. And we did a lot of this in ITE. We discussed open-ended and closed-ended questions to sort of elicit the right response from the person calling. Now, I wish I was following along properly. I'd sort of gathered ahead. Have you got any questions at the moment, gang? Oh, here we go. I found it, gathering information. One of the good things to ask is, what is the error message? If you're dealing with a client who's called up you as the help desk, or you're one of your clients who you can now get money for because you're going to pass discovery, and I was getting money off a friend of mine the other night when I was securing her network. You basically ask them what the error messages are, ask them, have you made any changes to your equipment in the last little while? If possible, get a copy of all log files and a listing of equipment configurations. You're back, huh?
Tenfold.
That wasn't my battery or glasses turning up, was it?
I think it might have been your battery.
Oh, beauty. All right. So there you go. I flattened the battery on the way over there. You can open it up and check if you like, because obviously they don't want to put Braille in there, but yeah, if you want to check, that's fine.
All right, where are we at?
Okay, I just found where we were at. You're still just asking questions, checking the make and model of devices, that sort of stuff, ownership and warranty information, that sort of thing. That's probably a little bit... Yeah, a couple of paragraphs down from where you were.
Okay, so did you cover the questions and stuff?
No, I just loosely said open-ended and closed-ended questions, so yeah, you can fire the questions.
Okay, so some of the questions that you can ask include, what are the end-user experiences? In other words, are they having trouble? Can they not connect to the network at all? Is it slow? What's actually occurring with the end-user? Observe symptoms. You know, my computer's running slow, I can't connect to the network, my connections are incredibly slow, or whatever. Error messages. Are you getting any error messages? That's an important one. And information about recent configuration changes, devices, or applications. Did you install any new software on your computer recently, or did somebody else do that for you, etc.? Okay, those can always be valuable. Next, what equipment is affected? You want to get copies of log and configuration files. That can be helpful. Other information about equipment includes things such which is the manufacturer, the make and model of devices affected, and ownership and warranty information. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let me just give you a heads up. If you find out a piece of equipment is under warranty, don't touch it. Just don't touch it. Leave that to the warranty, because anything you do at that point might void their warranty, and that would not be a good thing. Having said that, though, I can tell you a story. My dad had bought a PC from this company, and he was just having nothing but trouble with it. He was living in Arizona here at the time, actually, and I was still living in Texas. Interestingly enough, a year later, I showed up out in Arizona, but anyway. So he says, I'm just going to fly you out. We've talked this over on the phone. We've had nothing but trouble. I'm going to fly you out. Good excuse to see you anyway. I haven't seen you in 10 years. That's fine. Cool. I can do that. Well, the first thing that happened was I got out there, and I go in to plug a speech synthesizer in because it was old enough to where I was using hardware synths at the time. Damn, this thing is hot. I'm going, Dad, the power supply in this thing is toast, and it's making your computer toast. Fan's not working here. Then I looked and I saw that his BIOS battery was low. I said, this thing is under warranty. We're going to take it back. Well, they were closed Monday and Tuesday. We went and lo and behold, the whole place was boarded up. So much for a warranty. Yes, so much. So you might want to get, you know.
It's the dodgy brother computer dealer.
Yeah. So anyway, the other thing that you might want to check is the version of the firmware or software, because there can be compatibility problems with particular hardware platforms, etc. So you need to make sure that the version of hardware and software are compatible with one another. There are also some network monitoring tools that you can use to gather information about the network. Once you've gathered the necessary information, then it's time to go ahead and start the troubleshooting process. And they have a little troubleshooting checklist here, like under the nature of problem. They have the end user report, problem verification report. Under equipment, they have manufacturer, make, model, firmware version, operating system version, ownership, warranty information, configuration and topology, physical and logical topology. We've discussed the differences there, configuration files, and log files. You should also document previous troubleshooting steps and results, obviously, so that you don't rehash old ground. As I mentioned earlier, there are several techniques that can be used when troubleshooting. These include a top-down approach, a bottom-up approach, and a divide-and-conquer approach. All of these assume a layered concept of networking, such as the OSI model that we discussed. One of the things that you can do is verify the functionality of each layer until the problem is identified and isolated. Top-down starts with what layer, guys?
Applications.
Absolutely.
Good stuff.
Okay, it starts with the application layer, and it looks at the problem from the point of view of the user and the application. For example, is it one application that's functioning, or do every one of them fail? For example, let's say that a person can access some web pages on the internet, but they can't get their email. Well, that is not going to be a physical problem, is it? Because obviously the person is connected to the internet, etc. So we're going to have to look at that as an application layer problem. Okay. Then we look and we say, well, what about other workstations? Are they experiencing anything similar? Basically, the top-down troubleshooting approach starts at the application and works its way down until it finds the layer that's faulty. It's more suitable for simpler problems and those that are suspected to be application or upper layer problems. The advantages and disadvantages that obviously, if this is a lower layer problem, the technician has wasted an awful lot of time. But if you have reason to believe that it's an upper end layer, then it can really get to the problem, you know, quite quickly. The bottom-up approach starts with the physical layer and works up. Obviously, you remember that the physical layer is concerned with hardware and, you know, connections. So, you know, have cables been disconnected? What about the equipment LEDs? Are they on or off? Obviously, this always starts at the physical layer and works its way up until you find the faulty layer. The cases for which it's suitable is for really complex cases. The advantages or disadvantages. First, it's slow, but it works. It's solid. Obviously, if the problem is application or upper level layers, then it can take a long time to actually reach the solution. Divide and conquer. This is an approach that actually begins troubleshooting at one of the middle layers and then works up or down from there depending on what the technician finds. For example, the technician might begin at the network layer and identify, you know, IP configuration information, etc. It usually starts at either the data link, the network or transport layer. Basically, what the technician does is due to his or her experience, as well as the reported issues, you know, the technician will start from a layer and work up or down from there depending on what they find. It's most suitable when the person is an experienced technician and also when the problem has fairly precise symptoms. If done right, it approaches the layer that's faulty faster than other approaches. However, the technician usually does need some experience to use this approach effectively. More experienced individuals may use less structured techniques. Some of these will include trial and error and substitution. Trial and error kind of relies on individual knowledge to determine the cause of a problem. A person basically makes an educated guess based on past knowledge and also knowledge of the network structure in which you're involved. And once the solution is implemented, if it doesn't work, then the person uses that information to, you know, go on and find another step. And this process is repeated until the process is, or the problem is isolated and solved. It does have the potential to be extremely fast, but it does kind of rely on the knowledge and experience of the troubleshooter, and if he or she is good, that tends to bode better for this process. However, sometimes it can result in incorrect assumptions and thereby overlooking simple solutions. Substitution, we've talked about this in ITE1, it's substituting a known good part. Basically, you know, the problem is assumed to be caused by something that's defective, be that a hardware component, a bad configuration file, or whatever. And so the defective file or hardware device is replaced by a known good substitute. It may not necessarily locate the problem, but it can restore network functionality very quickly. Obviously, it relies on the availability of parts and stuff, which, you know, if it happens to be a computer or something, that can be, you know, kind of expensive to maintain a whole bunch of them. So, you know, one example is probably one that every one of you folks have encountered when an ISP decides to send you a new modem rather than send somebody out to diagnose your problem.
Jackie had that at the beginning of the year.
We had this at the beginning of the year, and actually, I mean, they sent me a modem and everything else, and that seemed to work for a while, and then it didn't. And man, I tell you what, I was so depressed. I was in the market for a new ISP.
Oh, no.
And one day, I just decided. I said, you know, I don't like the look of this cable. I think I'm gonna try the one that they sent me with my modem, because I hadn't bothered to, you know, crawl under the desk, and lo and behold, it worked like a charm. Yay! I was pretty embarrassed. Anyway, Elise, I'm done. If you guys don't have any questions, it's your turn.
Silence is golden. What do you think? I hope. troubleshooting issues. Just turn the volume down a bit here. A large proportion of network-related problems are related to the physical layer, or, you know, cabling and that sort of thing. One such problem I had the other night, I secured my friend's wireless network on Tuesday night over at Deb's place, and I went to get on her computer just to make sure everything was all on one of her computers, and no connectivity. Oh dear. She goes, oh, what's happened? I said, well, it's nothing I've done because my connection is still there. She didn't know how the computer was connected. She thought it might have been connected wirelessly, and I said, well, I can't actually find any wireless devices on this thing. So I fortunately had a spare piece of Ethernet cable, so I don't even know whether it ever was connected to Ethernet or wireless, but I thought, damn it, I haven't got time to muck around with it. There's a typical layer one problem for you. Maybe one of the people who visit had nicked off with the cable because she has people going in and out of that office. So who knows? Anyway, little layer one problem there, easy fix. Physical problems, of course, are concerned with the hardware layer, of course, and networking devices and the cables connecting them. I've just said that. Physical problems can occur in both wired and wireless networks. One of the best detection methods of detecting physical problems is the use of the senses. Yes! Smell, touch, sight if you have it, taste if you like to, I don't know, leak battery terminals or something. But suffice it to say, that's what I did. I reached around the back looking for a wireless network card or looking for any sort of network card on this computer, and all I found was a nice big fat network card there with nothing plugged in it. So yes, particularly being blind, you get to use your hands rather well for reaching around the back of computers and that sort of stuff, whereas our sighted counterparts tend to have to pull things out to look. Smell is good for if things want to get overheated. Obviously the sense of sight or vision is used to detect problems such as improperly connected or poorly constructed cables. Yep. Cables that may be connected to the wrong port, loose cable connections, damaged cables and connected, and well, Jackie used her sense of touch to find that, but suffice it to say it was a damaged cable that was causing her packet loss on her modem that she just talked about. And as we know, because we all did Chapter 3, the use of the wrong type of cable. Vision allows us to, if you have it that is, views the functionality of various network LEDs, like or the device LEDs. It's a light flashing. Is it yellow? Is it green? Is it gold? Is it red? What's it doing? And sometimes knowing what it says in the manual, a green flashing light indicates data might be going through there. A constant light might mean that the connection's there but no data's going through it. No light at all might mean that something's not even plugged in or powered up. So those sorts of things. So yeah, even if you're vision impaired and you're on a help desk, or if you're talking to somebody over the phone and you're talking to a sighted person, ask them what the lights are doing. And if you're troubleshooting a known device, like I was doing a Belcon the other day, that was easy enough to work with. I've done those before, and I've done a fair share of Linksys. It doesn't take too long to get used to them and know what, you know, Linksys put for their flashing lights, what that denotes and that sort of stuff. The sense of smell. Yeah, go ahead, Kylie.
Sorry, yeah. Guys, learn what it says in the notes about the Linksys, because you will be asked what lights are for what in exams. So it might seem really irrelevant, but they'll ask you. So, yeah, better learn it.
Yeah, and the Linksys is reasonably indicative of many other vendors or brands of modems or ISRs or routers or whatever. My Netcom was very similar, and it didn't have a red light for no internet, but it did have a light just went out basically. But yeah, the flashing and flickering and stuff that goes on when there's data being transmitted is very similar. So the Linksys is, if you get to know the Linksys, it puts you in good stead for some of the others. The sense of smell can
Where
I can
check your documentation though.
Yeah, the sense of smell can alert you to the components overheating. We've done that before. The smell of burning insulation or overheating components is a very distinct smell and can really alert you that something's wrong. The sense of touch, which is what Jackie used with her father's computer, can feel for overheated components. I've done the same. I had a friend back in 2004, the same thing. The computer was just continuously shutting down. I just happened to put my hand around the back of it when I was over there one afternoon. I said, there's your problem. Fan's not even going. And you can detect the fact that the cooling fans aren't going. If you get a big game, you can sort of touch them, but it's not recommended for for people who aren't as good as dexterity as I am, perhaps. Just because I file my fingernails on a computer fan doesn't mean to say everybody else should. Some of these components can vibrate and make different noises. Sometimes the oil in the fans will get a bit dry, and you'll notice a noise when you first turn your computer on until it warms up. Sometimes a bit of a tap on the back will stop it, but usually it means that the fan needs a bit of oiling. The absence of certain vibrations or the presence of excessive vibrations can also mean that things can be wrong. The sense of hearing can be used to detect major problems such as electrical issues and the proper operation of cooling fans and disk drives. Absolutely. There's probably been a few of us around Cavi who have heard the odd hard disk going ticker from time to time. That usually means the hard disk is cratering. Fans not spinning when they ought to be, or fans making excessive noise like the oily fan, etc. So get used to those sounds. I mean, say, I had to get used to it in here. I shut down my old Challenger server because I retired it. And as Kylie and Jackie will well know, the first thing I noticed was the presence of less noise in the room because I was so used to hearing this thing whirring away day in, day out. It's a lot quieter in here now. But had anything gone wrong on that machine, I would have been aware of it pretty quickly because I was used to its noise. Anyway, that's that bit. Any questions at this point? All right, into the connectivity section we go of chapter 9.2.2. There are a number of software utility programs that can help identify network problems. Now, in the worksheet for chapter 8, people were asked to install the Microsoft utility that gave you a little bit of information about your network, but not a great deal. The LARC will tell you about your network. Some of us in KVM are using that. However, there are some command line utilities that are built into Windows, which I was also using the other night. Now, we all know what a CLI is, gang, right? That's it. And how do we bring it up, folks?
Run CMD, enter.
That's it. Our Windows R, yep. Now, the syntax for these commands may vary between operating systems, but essentially, what we see in Windows is often what we get in Linux. Some of the available utilities are ipconfig. It displays IP configuration information. Ping will test connections to other IP hosts. Trace route, or trace RT, TRACERT for Windows users. I think you spell the whole thing out for Linux, will display the route taken to the destination. So if we go traceroute cisco.com, we'll see, and then we did some of these back in IT, I think, we'll be able to see all the hops between your computer, your local network, and your ISP, and any hops between your ISP and Cisco. Netstat, which I think Kylie was asking the other day, displays network connections. And in actual fact, Jackie was playing with it yesterday and noticed a whole heap of odd connections to different places, and that was because she was on Skype at the time. So if you are going to play with that and you see a few connections and you happen to have your Skype running at the time, you'll see connections to all sorts of things. Before we knew about hijack this from Trend Micro, we actually used it to troubleshoot a virus or a Trojan we had back in 2007. It had dodgy connections open to all sorts of IP addresses and dodgy domain names, which we found using Netstat-B, capital B. The other one is NSLookup, and that queries the name server for information on a destination domain. So there's five things that you need to be aware of, and we'll examine these in greater detail. So they are ipconfig, ping, traceroute, Netstat, and NSLookup. So let's look at these. So these are mentioned. These are really good tools to get to learn, play with.
And I believe we talked about these a little bit in Chapter 8.
We might have, yep. How are we going for time, gang? Yeah, all right. I was going to get people to crack open a few command lines, but I think they're running a bit low on time. Okay, with ipconfig. If we issue this command from the command prompt, as I think most of you know now, you get what? Let's find out. You get the basic configuration information, you get your own IP address for your computer. That should be a what, guys? Probably a local IP address if you're on a internal network, a subnet mask, and a default gateway. Did you want to tell your story at this point, Jay, or did you want to do it nearer the end?
No, we'll wait.
All right. The question the utility answers is, do I have the right IP address, subnet mask, and default gateway? And you can find out more information by typing ipconfig/all. You get additional information like the MAC address. MAC addresses are associated with layer what, gang?
Two.
Thank you, dear. You'll get the IP you'll get the IP address of the default gateway and your DNS server that you're connected to. It will also tell you whether the DHCP is enabled. It will tell you the address of the DHCP server and the lease information as to how long you've had that IP address handed out by that server. How can this utility assist in the troubleshooting process? Very easy. Without an appropriate IP configuration, guess what? Nothing happens. You don't get communications. If the host, also, if your host or your computer doesn't know the location of the DNS servers, it cannot translate names into IP addresses. For example, cisco.com can't be looked up, or lonsdalemedia.com.au can't be looked up. As we learnt back in IT1, if you go ipconfig/release, R-E-L-E-A-S-E, and that will release the current IP configuration, and ipconfig/renew will renew it and request another DHCP. We'll put out a DHCP request and look for another, request another IP address. So basically releases the current DHCP bindings, and renew will refresh, will ask for new configuration details. It can happen, and I have seen it happen on my EEE from time to time, where a host may contain faulty or outdated information, and a simple renewal of this information is all that's needed to get connectivity restored. If after releasing and renewing the IP configuration, and a host is unable to connect, it could be that there's simply no DHCP server available, and you may have to statically assign your IP addressing information. Another troubleshooting step might be is just to verify that the network interface card has an illuminated link light on the back of it. Verify your connections. We're actually in when we're using these utilities, we're in the divide and conquer method, and we'll discuss that later in the chapter. So yeah, make sure you've got a physical connection to the network. The first thing I did when I did an IP config on Deb's computer the other day and found nothing there, I just went straight around the back of the computer to see whether there was an antenna for a wireless network card or an Ethernet, and there was no wireless network card, so maybe they were using a USB one at some point, but there was an Ethernet one there, so I plugged a cable in it and it worked like a mad thing. It was good. So very easy fixed. Troubleshooting using ping. Now, what do you think ping does, guys? We can sort of ping a website, ping a local integrated services router if we know its IP address. So, if we know that the IP configuration is fine, we can also ping localhost too, which means if you can't ping localhost, you're not going to ping anything else. So that's ping 127.0.0.1. But most people tend to ping a destination host and see if it's reachable. The question this utility ping answers is, can I send an IP packet to another host? The ping command can be followed by an IP address or a domain name. So you can go ping 192.168.1.1. On some people's routers, you might get Kylie's router, I don't know. If you came into my place and went and pinged 192.168.1.254, you would get my local gateway, and you would get my local integrated services router. Or if you pinged lonsdalemedia.org, you would get my external IP address, I do believe. So there you go. The example given here in the notes is ping space www.cisco.com. When a ping is sent to an IP address, go ahead, Jay.
Bear in mind that some IP addresses and some hosts don't accept ping.
Yes, I did that to an address the other night from Deb's place. Oh, yeah, the ping's not working on that server. Okay, good. If you do ping somewhere, oddly enough, Google has ping turned on. And the amount of people pinging Google just to see they've got an internet connection must be phenomenal. It must get flooded with these requests. Okay, when a ping is sent to an IP address, a packet known as an echo request is sent across the network to the IP address specified. If the destination host receives the request, it responds with a packet known as an echo reply. If the source receives that echo reply, connectivity is verified. If a ping is sent to a name, such as www.cisco.com, a packet is first sent to a DNS server, that resolves the name to an IP address. So there you go. It goes straight to the IP address. If it's sent to the IP address, it'll go straight to the destination. But if you're pinging a domain name, it has to be looked up and then sent on. Once the IP address is obtained from the DNS server, the echo request is forwarded to the IP address and the process proceeds as normal. Now, if a ping to the IP address succeeds but the ping to the domain name doesn't, what does that mean, gang? Well, I'll tell you.
No DNS for me.
Kylie gets it. No DNS. Did somebody else mic up? No. No. Okay, well done, Kylie. Well, you passed, so you should know this. Okay. If the pings to both IP address and domain name is successful, and the user is still unable to access the application, it says here, then there could be a problem with the application on destination host. Oh, I get what they're trying to say here. All right. Okay. You might try and ping mail.lonsdalemedia.org, for example, and it doesn't come back. But you know lonsdalemedia.org is there. That will mean that the mail server or XM is not running on my server, is basically what they're trying to tell you here. So you can ping certain parts of the server. If you just ping the domain name, you'll get the server back. But if you ping mail.lonsdalemedia.org, you'll get my mail server or the SMTP part of it. If neither ping successful, network connectivity is obviously bad. Okay, now, what do you think... If this occurs, what would your next step be, gang, if you couldn't ping an outside host?
Can we ping the default gateway?
Someone's learnt their discovery. Yeah, that's exactly what it says in the notes. Yep, try something local, a bit closer to home. Okay, if the ping to the default gateway is successful, then the problem is not local. So that's when you ring up your internet service provider and they go, have you checked all browser settings? And you go, oh, I don't want to hear that. Obviously, if the ping to the... gateway fails, then the problem exists on your local network and you don't ring up your ISP. Basically, the basic Windows ping command issue is for echo request. You might. Well, if you can't ping up your local gateway.
If the ISR is shot, for example, then obviously you're not going to be able to ping up your local gateway. And so, but it still might involve a call to the ISP to replace it.
I forgot most of our students live in the land of milk and honey, where, yes, the internet service providers send out ISRs. Here, down under, they only send you a modem. Blah. We just have to go and buy a new ISR from the local dealer. All right, so there you go. Difference between our countries and cultures. All right, so yes, you can ring up your internet service provider. So give us another modem, router, thing, device, if you wanted. If you're an American.
One thing you could also do is ping localhost.
Absolutely.
Make sure that your TCP/IP stack is installed properly.
And if it isn't, don't look any further. There you go.
Don't call your ISP.
No, don't. So if you can't get anything back from 127.0.0.1, fix your local computer.
Yeah, you're screwed.
The default of the ping is four echo requests, but I think with a switch or two you can get more out of it. It says here in the notes. Troubleshooting using Traceroute. I love Traceroute. It's rather cool. And I think a lot of people are doing this in ITE. While the ping utility can verify end-to-end connectivity, sometimes a problem can exist and you can't ping the destination. The ping utility really doesn't tell you where it drops out. So you might go, all right, let's go ping Google, google.com, and nothing happens. And you go, well, that's terrible. Google's gone and crashed. Well, Google won't go and crash. Or you've got no network connectivity, but you think there's something going a lot more. All right, a good example is that Skype might be still working. So what we're going to do is we're going to use Traceroute, and we're going to find out at what hop the signal drops out or the packets get lost, because packets can get dropped. The Traceroute utility basically provides information about the path that a packet takes to reach a destination. It also indicates how long a packet takes to get to the destination and the round trip back. No? Oh, round trip time, it says here. Yeah, so it does. So sometimes we've used Traceroute to test the speed of our connections, and we've gone, well, this is really cruddy here. We're getting so many milliseconds and we should only be getting less. And we go, isn't that terrible? Right, ring up the ISP. Have you checked all browser settings? No, don't want to hear that. Okay, so basically the question that the Traceroute utility answers is, what route will my packets take to reach another host and in how much delay will there be? So a trace route can identify exactly where a packet has been lost or delayed. Basic trace route utility will only allow it 30 hops between a source and destination before it assumes that the destination is unreachable. This option is adjustable using the dash H parameter, so you can change the hops and do a trace route dash help or slash help or something and find out some more options if you get curious and got nothing better to do with your life.
We had a worksheet on this earlier, didn't we?
Yeah, yep. You probably did, yep.
If it doesn't work, though, traceroute probably isn't going to, because they both use ICMP, which is, if it's turned off, on the particular servers, neither ping or traceroute is going to work. So
traceroute will at least get you a few hops away from it.
Yeah, true.
The Windows firewall blocks ICMP by default, I think.
It blocks it coming in, but not going out.
Yeah, that sounds right. Any questions, gang? As I enjoy my orange juice so early in the morning. Netscape.
It's not as early in the morning as it used to be.
Well, that's indeed right. I was thinking about it. We started at 8 o'clock this morning because we had daylight saving. Yay. People have been asking about traceroute. No, they haven't. Netstat, rather. We've just done traceroute. Netstat, lovely utility, because we trapped a virus with it a few years ago, didn't we? Okay. Sometimes we need to know what connections are open, and we can see connections. If I did a netstat now, I would see a connection open to darkstar.com. I think it is darkstarllc.com rather. That is because I'm talking on Ventrilo. I would probably see a connection open to my local mail server, because to me my mail server is local, so I would see a connection open to 192.168.1.12. Skype's running, so God only knows what's open there. And I am still sitting on a couple of those websites that Jackie and I were messing with before we started class, so I would see a connection maybe to that host. So we can use this Netstat utility to verify those connections. Sometimes netstat-B will give you heaps of information, and you can pipe that to a text file and then send it to a technician for troubleshooting. Because what it does, it lists the protocol in use, the port number, the foreign address, the foreign address port and port number, and the state of the connection. So when we saw dodgy IP addresses to dodgy IP to dodgy hosts like www.wearebunchoftrojanwriters.com or whatever they called themselves, or nothing that obvious, we went, we got something running on this machine we didn't like. The question this utility answers is, what are my active network connections and which TCP/UDP ports are in use? It says here, unexplained TCP connections can pose a security threat. Duh. Yes, we didn't like our little Trojan connecting to where a bunch of dodgy TrojanWriters.com, so we had to nobble it. That actually was back in the days of taking hard drives out of computers and mounting them under Linux to squash the virus, but that's another story. Kerry's doing a lecture on how to back up a computer using Linux today, if you're interested. Yes, well, basically, this business of unexplained TCP connections can be a threat, of course, because it really, really tells us that somebody or something may be connected to our computer that ought not to be connected to our computer, and we don't want that. Also, additionally, unnecessary TCP connections can consume valuable network resources or the host resources, thus slowing down performance. Netstat should be used to examine the open connections on a host when performance appears to be compromised. Yes, we noticed our machines in the bad old days. We actually talked to AVG about it, told them about it, because I had a license. So my friend Will was running the free edition, I was running the paid for one. I said, well, let's write him a letter and we'll do it on my behalf. Because I think the AGV developing type people were here in Melbourne somewhere. So there you go. They were quite grateful. Many useful options are available for the netstat command. I think if you do a dash H or dash question mark, you'll get them all. Dash question mark, I think it is. Okay, any questions on netstat? NS lookup. Now, I remember Kylie dealing with this a few weeks back. Okay, we can either just go NS lookup and you get a prompt of its own. Or you can go NS lookup space domain name or IP address and it will tell you about it. Let's have a look at the notes. When accessing applications or services across the network, individuals usually rely on the DNS name instead of the IP address. Absolutely. It's far better to remember Cisco.com than whatever its IP is. When a request is sent to that name, a host must first contact the DNS server to resolve the name to the corresponding IP. Yep. cool. It's all good. The host then uses IP to package the information for delivery. The question that the NS Lookup utility answers is, what is the IP address of www.xyz corporation? Well, I don't know that there is one, but anyway, there it is. Oh, xyz.com. So what is the IP address of lonsdalemedia.org, or what is the IP address of sixgo.com? We can look up a particular DNS name in the DNS server with it. When the NS Lookup command is issued, the information it returns includes the IP address of the DNS server that is in use, the IP address of the DNS server and the associated that's associated with a specified DNS name. I'm getting confused with that bit. Basically, I use it as a troubleshooting tool to see if the DNS server is performing the name resolution properly. Or if I just see a funny looking IP address from somewhere, like I often have a look at my mail headers to find out where the Mr. Spam was coming from, and I might do a DNS lookup on their IP address and find it's probably coming from where a bunch of dodgy virus writers.com. There's a diagram here. I might skip that. So read your notes, because we're starting to run low on time. All right. I'll get you to read the notes on the diagram because it's reasonably well specified. Are there any questions before we hand over to Jackie to do common issues? How did you go with all that in the worksheets, Kylie? Because I know you've done them all. Did it all make sense?
Yes, it did. We're not doing nines, by the way. I think we need to...
Oh yeah, we're not doing the nine worksheets because it's a troubleshooting that revolves you to be in a lab with an instructor and they make a network and they break it. The students make a network and the instructor goes there and breaks it and the students have to go and fix it. However, if we do get time, which is now looking not likely, we might discuss that and see how good you are at troubleshooting. Jackie?
Yeah, is it all right if I make a real quick emergency announcement
here? Yep, go for it.
Yeah, I just was notified that on Saturday, starting at 1900 hours GMT, or 12 noon Pacific time, Cisco is going to be out for several hours. So guys, do not write us on Saturday saying, I can't take my exam. We can't help you. The website's going to be down. So, all right.
There you go.
Let's talk about common issues in troubleshooting. One of the most common issues that you're going to see is connectivity issues. Obviously, these occur on wired networks, wireless networks, and networks that use both. When you have to troubleshoot a network using both, it's often best to use a divide-and-conquer technique to try to determine whether it's the wired or the wireless network. Obviously, what you're going to want to do is, for example, ping from the wireless client to the default gateway. Now, if we can connect, then obviously this verifies that the wireless client is connecting as expected. If it's not, then you need to go on and troubleshoot, you know, the various kinds of wireless connectivity types of issue. Obviously, if the wireless client is working, then try the wired client. Go ahead and ping from the wired client to the default gateway and see if that's working. Then the third step is to ping from a wireless client to a wired client to see if that's working. Obviously, this should help isolate where the problem lies. Another thing that you want to look at is LED indicators. Obviously, this can tell you the current state of activity of a piece of equipment or connection. LEDs may change color or flash. Unfortunately, if you're totally blind like me, it's not helpful. You do have to know what the exact meaning of the codes are, though, and so you will definitely need to consult the documentation for the equipment. Three types of LEDs are commonly found on devices, and these are power LEDs, status LED, and activity LED. On some devices, actually a single LED can, you know, actually convey information, but, you know, this is why you have to check the equipment documentation. Do not make any assumptions. You know what you do when you assume. You make one of you and me, and you can't make it one out of me because I won't let you. But anyway, okay. An active LED has maybe an indication of either a device failure, a port failure, or cabling issues. It's possible that a device might be non-functional simply due to bad hardware. A port may have failed, or there may be improperly configured software. It's at fault. You want to verify that the hardware and the ports are up and functional before you spend large amounts of time trying to troubleshoot other issues. It really, folks. Seriously. They talk a little bit about LEDs on a Linksys. There's a security LED, and that indicates the current, you know, state of security. Usually that's solid green to indicate that security is enabled. Activity LEDs. There's three of them. There's the wireless LED, there's internet, and ethernet. These are sometimes referred to as link lights, and they're often associated with a specific port. If there is supposed to be traffic on these particular things, and there usually is, it's an activity light, then usually the light will flash. So flash, just think about flashing indicates as the data goes through, it's, you know, flashing. Sometimes the rate of flashing indicates the speed. Solid green indicates on the Linksys router anyway that the device is plugged in, but there's no traffic going through it. And flashing green indicates that it's plugged in or receiving traffic. Amber indicates that the device is making adjustments to the port. And no light indicates that either nothing is plugged into the port or there's some kind of issue with the connection. Obviously, the exact meaning of these lights is going to vary by equipment manufacturer. The power of the LED is usually... Yeah.
Sometimes the PPP light on my router might go red, which means it's having one of its authentication issues with the ISP. So the connection's there, but we're not getting the PPP layer, so they can sometimes change to a red color. Sorry,
Jay. Oh, no problem. Usually, the power light is solid green, and no light indicates some kind of problem. If that happens, check your power connection. Really? Okay. So, let's do a little troubleshooting with connectivity problems. For example, a wired host can't connect to the integrated router. One of the first thing you want to do is check your physical connectivity and cabling. Obviously, it's one of the most common issues when you're experiencing inactivity on a wired network. Okay. Make sure that the correct type of cable is used. Remember that you can have straight through or crossover cables. You want to use the right type of cable here, and usually that is a straight through cable. Now, sometimes, some of these newer, more modern devices can actually sense what type of cable is being used and compensate accordingly, but I wouldn't chance that. Improper cable termination. Make sure that cables are terminated according to standards in order to avoid that. And make sure that it's either 568A or 568B, or if it's a crossover, you know, one on each end. Avoid untwisting too much cable. And make sure that you crimp the cable terminations on the jacket to avoid, you know, stress relief on the cable. You know, there are maximum cable lengths that you're not supposed to exceed, and exceeding these can have a serious impact on network performance. So know the standards for the particular type of cable you're using, and don't exceed run lengths. And remember that run lengths, you know, have to do with things like over the door and around corners and etc. So make sure that the correct ports are being used between the networking devices, obviously. Protect cables and connectors from physical damage. Try to run cable through areas that won't be in the way, and support cables to prevent strain on connectors. Let's talk a little bit about troubleshooting a wireless LAN. If a wireless host can't connect to the AP, then we have to look at a couple of things. Obviously, wireless relies on radio frequency signals to carry the data, and many factors can affect these RF signals. Okay, remember that not all wireless standards are compatible. So, you know, like 80211A is not compatible with G, for example. So, and even within the 2.4 GHz band, each, you know, technology is different. Make sure that, you know, the equipment is compatible. That's just an absolute necessity. Remember, too, that each wireless conversation have to occur on a separate and non-overlapping channel. Some access points can be, in fact, configured to select the least congested channel. And a lot of modern devices do this. And so it's usually a good thing to put your AP on auto. There's places where you can set this in the router, generally speaking. And it's usually a good thing to put it on auto. But, you know, if you're having issues, you might try changing that. Sometimes, though, you know, manual setting may be necessary. It certainly, you know, provides more control. And some environments may prove that to be necessary. So remember also that the strength of an RF signal decreases with the distance. So if the signal strength is too low, they may not very well be able to connect with the access point, and the signal may be dropped. The Windows XP wireless configuration doesn't do it as well, but a lot of the NIC client utilities that are used often can display the signal strength much better and let, you know, a person know what the signal strength is actually doing. Remember also that you can get interference to wireless from outside sources, such as, you know, microwave, cell phones, cordless phones, etc. So you may wish to do a site survey to detect, you know, where where interference might be coming from. Remember that APS share bandwidth, so if you have more than one, that can be a problem. Also, as more devices associate with the APS, the bandwidth for each individual device, you know, decreases. So if I have two computers on my wireless AP, you know, maybe my bandwidth is like, I don't know, 512, say. Each get 256, and obviously if four come in, then each is going to get, you know, 128 or whatever it is. So just understand that the more devices you have connecting, the less bandwidth each gets. Does anybody have any questions about that? Okay, then my next is going to be troubleshooting wireless association and authentication. Obviously, one of the things that really needs to happen with wireless is that it needs to be secured. And unfortunately, though, incorrect configuration of these security settings can prevent connectivity and communication. Some of the most commonly incorrectly configured settings will include the SSID, which is the service set identifier, which is the name that you see of your network, authentication, and encryption. So these are some settings that have to be correct in order for communication to occur. The SSID is case sensitive. It can be as many as 32 alphanumeric characters, and it must match on both the AP and the client. So if my network name is McBride's with a capital M and a capital B, and I put it on my client, my computer, in all lowercase letters, I ain't connecting. Now, this isn't an issue if the SSID is broadcast and detected, but if you are entering it manually, you do have to make sure that your capitalization is correct. Also, if two, you know, access points are present and both are broadcasting the same SSID, then there is the possibility that the client will associate with an access point that you don't necessarily want it to associate with. So, unfortunately, on most access points, open authentication is configured by default. Open means www.freeinternetforall. Yes.
Which is the way it was over at Deb's place up until Tuesday night.
I have a friend, and I keep saying, you know what, you need to let me come over and secure your network. She works online, and she doesn't have her network secured, and I'm just going, you know, one of these days you are going to get something, and it's going to bring down everything. It makes me shudder. Obviously, to configure a more secure form of communication, you're going to need an encryption key, and the client and the AP have to be configured with the same key. And if the keys don't match, then guess what? You're not going to get connected. Encryption is the process of altering the data so that it's not usable by anyone without the proper encryption key. And obviously, if encryption is enabled, the same key, again, has to be enabled on both the access point and on the client. And if the client and the AP can associate but cannot send data to each other, then it's the encryption key that may be the issue. All right, DHCP. You know that DHC stands for Dynamic Host Controller Configuration Protocol. Obviously, if you have physical connectivity, then you will want to check the IP configuration of the client. Obviously, this can have a major impact on the host's ability to connect to the network. You know that every host on a network has to have an IP. Normally, the ISR that you have acts as a DHCP server for in most circumstances. What this will give you at least is the IP address, the subnet mask, the default gateway, and possibly even the IP address of DNS servers, possibly. The DHCP actually will bind an IP address to the client's MAC address and store that in a table, and you can actually look at that in certain routers. Obviously, the client information should match the local host information that you can get with a ipconfig/all. And you need to make sure that the client address is on the same network as the router. Otherwise, there's a problem. And obviously, the router that you have should be set as the default gateway. If there is disagreement with the IP config and the table, then do a IP config release and then renew and see if that can form a new binding and rectify the problem. If the clients, the wired and wireless clients, say, for example, can connect to the Linksys device but can't ping one another, then the problem might be occurring on the router. So check, make sure that, you know, there are no security settings on the router that would prevent pinging of clients. All right, so the next thing that you have to make sure of is the router to the ISP connection. You can usually suspect that this is a problem if wired and wireless hosts can connect to each other, but not to the internet. Obviously, you need to make sure that the, you know, integrated router and the ISP connection in a situation like this is okay. And there are several ways that you can do this. If you go into your router, there's usually a status page, and it will tell you, you know, like how many packets are being sent and received. It should tell you the publicly assigned IP address, the one that's assigned by your ISP to your router. Obviously, if it shows no connection, your router probably isn't connected. Make sure that you know, all the cables and everything is good. If you have a, you know, separate DSL or cable connection modem, then you have to, you know, check those as well. Make sure that the login and password is correct. Your username and password is correct. Again, this is usually available in the setup page of the router configuration. I don't know if any of you have configured your router or gone into your, you know, router, but that is that's something that all Discovery students should do. Sometimes there's a connect or IP address renew that you can click. In Windows, you know, you can go to network connections and right-click your network connection port, either LAN or wireless, and sometimes there's a repair link there that you can try. You might need to contact your ISP to make sure that there are no internet outage issues. You know, you can try for hours and hours, but obviously if a cable got chopped up in your area, or a tree fell down on a DSL terminal or something, then you're probably not going to connect.
Well, your internet server switched you off, as it did with Mario.
Even though he did pay his bill.
That's it.
Obviously, if you try pinging something and it doesn't work, try pinging another site just to make sure that, you know, that site isn't down or ping isn't being, blocked. And I think I'm done.
And if you're listening out there in listener land, Joe, you might want to try some of these and find out where your cratering internet connection is cratering. We love you lots, Joe, but you're not with us. Any questions?
And we miss you.
We miss you. Want you back.
Too late now.
Too late now. He's going to miss the end of the class. Oh, well, he'll get the lecture down. Troubleshooting in the help desk. Oh, boy. Here we go. Oh, we just love this bit. Network documentation is an important part of any troubleshooting process. Yeah, all right. How many things do we do? And we don't write it down. Craig and I all made wikis a little while ago, and I believe Kerry did the same. And all three of us now have them crated, so we have to do that when we get back from Arizona and find out why a wiki died and go and fix it so we can actually put stuff in it that we do. Because we were doing a heap of stuff during the week and neither Craig and I have written it down, we'll probably forget how to do it the next time we need to do it, and that was all the security stuff we were doing on my mail server. All right. So, in the case of troubleshooting, of course, you may have an issue that you sorted, and the same issue crops up again a year later, and you go, oh dear, I've slept. I can't remember what I did to fix it. I know I fixed it, and it becomes frustrating. You can take a normal or baseline measurement of your network, so have a fair idea of how quickly you download stuff off the net, how reliable your service is, so that if it goes slow, or here when the rain occurs and the phone lines get a bit damp, and I notice a decrease in performance in my download speeds, etc., or Skype goes into narrow band when I'm trying to talk to Jackie, etc., or drops out or loses packets. We know that that's not the norm, although I was a bit worried about it earlier in the year, to be honest. So the performance baseline can include the types of traffic that's normally happens on your network, as well as the volume of traffic that can that travels between to and from network and other devices. If you're in a normal work situation, your baseline really should be documented when the network's running at an optimum level, so that should a problem arise, you can instantly identify and say, well, this is not normal. This is not, and you can tell your employer or the person who you're troubleshooting for, this is not normal, because I now have a baseline test here that says that we should be getting better performance. The baseline performance should be re-established after any major changes to your network. Additionally,
test alert.
Oh, we've got a test alert. Thank you, Kylie. If you're in an organisation, additionally, other documentation should be topology maps, the map of your network, network diagrams, addressing schemes. Yep, you might have the way you want your computers to be addressed. All of this can provide you valuable information if you're a troubleshooter trying to understand the physical layout of the network and the logical flow of information. When troubleshooting, documentation should be maintained through the troubleshooting process. Well, we tried this and it didn't work. We tried that and it didn't work. But we replaced this and it did work. As I said before, this documentation is a valuable reference and can be used in the future if the same or similar issues arise. Good troubleshooting documentation should include initial steps to isolate the problem, the results of all the steps that were taken, whether they be unsuccessful or successful. Determine the cause of the problem and final problem. Good grief, no punctuation. Okay. Resolution and preventative measures. So if you've taken any measures to prevent the problem from reoccurring, what did you do? Write it down. Using outside sources for help. If during the troubleshooting process the troubleshooter is unable to determine the problem, it might be necessary to obtain assistance from outside sources. Yep. Some of the most common sources may include previously kept documentation, online FAQs, frequently asked questions, colleagues and other network professionals, internet forums, yeah, right. You have to get past that. Oh, you're still not running that rubbish and all the crapola that goes on in forums. And documentation. Good documentation, yeah, right, can save a great deal of time and effort because it can direct the troubleshooter to the most likely cause of the problem and will provide the technical information required to isolate and correct your issues. The documentation provided with many network devices, however, often does not provide sufficient information to troubleshoot anything except for the most basic issues. Yeah. Any questions? Many manufacturers provide a series of frequently asked questions about the product or technology they have. Normally these are based on previous requests for help. With the increased availability of the internet, development of support forums, troubleshooters can get information and assistance on help from people in real time. So you can have chats and live chats and all that sort of stuff. Colleagues, they're a good source of information. Oi, what did you do to fix it last week? About what you'd say. And when they come back in from being at the pub, they might tell you if they remember. They can be a good source of troubleshooting and experience if you're working in an organisation. Using the help desk. Any questions at this point? Using the help desk. Here we go. Ugh. The help desk is usually the first stop for the end user. The help desk is a group of individuals with the knowledge and tools that are required to help them correct diagnose common problems. Yeah, right. Provides assistance to the end user if a problem exists and should provide the nature of the problem and the solution. Many companies and internet service providers establish help desks to help their users with their networking problems. Yeah, it commonly goes something like this. Have you checked your browser settings? Blah. Go away and learn something, will you? Most larger companies, we probably know more than most first level people here now, guys. By the way, so there you go, because you're all discovery students. Most larger companies, or most larger IT companies, will run help desks, and I've worked on them for their employees. That usually is so that it can support the in-house and common, you know, off-the-shelf applications that the companies often use. Then you get into the and refer to IT Chapter 10, folks. You know, you might get into SOEs and that sort of stuff, common standard operating environments, so that your computers are usually well configured with a particular known way, and makes the help desk job a lot easier. Here we go. For example, Cisco Systems offer help desk assistance for problems integrating Cisco equipment into networks or problems that may occur after installation. There are many ways to contact the help desk, including email, telephone, or live chat. While email is good for non-urgent problems, live chat or phone is good for in-network emergencies. Fast resolution or access by phone is particularly important for organisations like banks, where a small amount of downtime can cost actually a large amount of money. You can't have those traders offline for too long, the share market might go away. If necessary, and I've done this on help desks, and I do this now with my auntie, Jackie and I do this with my auntie quite a bit, when the Elise and Jackie help desk is going, don't we, Jay? We can remote access into her machine and do things. We can access software, we can troubleshoot, we can... Yeah, and well, that's where Jaws Tandem's becoming good for a lot of blind people, of course. Offer assistance by means of remote accessing in. On a help desk, this often allows help desk technicians to run diagnostic programs and interact with the host and the network without physically having to travel to a job site. This, of course, greatly reduces the wait time for problem resolution and allows the help desk to assist more users. As an end user, it is important for you to give the help desk as much information as you possibly can. The help desk may require information on any service or support plans that are in place along with any specific information about equipment. So some of these commercial help desks will have a service level agreement with a client. Some of the questions you might be asked about would be make, model, number and serial number of the equipment if you're doing hardware stuff on it. Sometimes the firmware that's operating on your device. If you're doing, you want a support call to a VoIP like me with Engine or something, they might ask for the IP address of the device, depending on what the situation is. The help desk will require information specific to your problem, such as systems encountered, who encountered the problem, when does the problem manifest, steps taken to identify the problem, results of steps already taken. If this is a follow-up call, be prepared to provide the following details: the date and time of the previous call, the ticket number if you know it, and the name of the technician also if you know it. please, please, please.
You know what?
Please.
Probably be asked to.
Go ahead, Jane.
To provide your serial number as well, so.
Yeah. Often are particularly dealing with vendor specific equipment, because I often check to see when it was purchased or that you are genuinely owning it. Yep, exactly. So serial number, I've been asked for that. I've had to troubleshoot something where I've rung up. I think I did when I was looking for a new keyboard from the AAA too. Anyway, we went and got a cheaper one. Please, 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 please be at the affected equipment. Of the defective equipment. Sit in front of the computer. Make the problem occur when you've got the help desk people on the phone. Don't ring up and say, oh, last night I couldn't get on the internet. It was 8 o'clock and here it is midday, lunchtime, the day after in your lunch break. Don't forget it. And please don't go trying to relay information through other people because other people won't read the error messages back and then you lose it in the translation and you're trying to tell someone about it over the phone. No. Be in front of the computer. I won't assist anyone unless they are a technician of my ilk, unless they are in front of the computer. There are those rare occasions, like I helped Jackie and Alison not long after I met Jackie, because she herself was proficient in telling Alison how to deal with her small issue at the time. Make sure the staff has access to the equipment if necessary. Okay, help desk is generally organised in a series of levels and experience and knowledge. This is usually level 1, 2 and 3, and I think I've seen it around some of the Cisco curriculum where it discusses this. Basically, the first level, if the first level staff are unable to resolve the issue, they will escalate the problem to a higher level. Higher level staff are generally more knowledgeable and have access to more resources and equipment than what the first level people have access to. Please record all information that you've had with the help desk, so it makes it easier next time if you have to continue with a problem. Time and date of your call, name and ID of technician if you can find it out, problem reported, course of action taken, resolution/escalation, and next steps/follow-up. Well, I'll be honest, half the time when I've rung up these people, I've been so stressed I haven't wanted to write any of it down. By working together with the help desk, most problems can be resolved quickly and easily. Yeah, right. Okay, pigs fly. Make sure once resolved, please make sure you update all documentation and references you have to this. No, some help desks are good. Look, in fairness, they do vary, don't they? I've had some really good experiences on ringing up for support. And I've had some not-so-good experiences. Any questions? We're up to 9.5, Jay.
And I believe that's the chapter summary, so why don't we...
chapter summary. We can do an Uncle Cisco.
Why don't we go ahead with our troubleshooting?
I think so. Let's do our troubleshooting, because you guys know this stuff.
We've got 25
minutes. All right. We've got 20 minutes. 25 more minutes of the discovery train, and it rolls into the last terminus.
25 more minutes.
Yeah. So we can do your little thing you were mentioning when you were in Casa Grande.
All right.
So here we go. Okay.
So here's what the scenario is, ladies and gentlemen. A year ago, August, I believe, maybe it was September, my husband and I decided to attend a ministry conference in a town called Casa Grande, i.e. we went to the big house. For those of you who don't know, over here, the big house usually means prison. And for those of you who don't know, Casa Grande means big house in Spanish. And it's a town in Arizona. Anyway, we went on a Friday evening.
Glad you clarified that, huh?
Yeah. That Friday morning, I had been working on the internet. When I got down to the hotel, I could not connect to the internet. They had wireless that you could use in the rooms, and I could not connect. What was my problem, and what did I do to fix it? And I did fix it, by the way. And I had just graduated from Discovery, guys, so you should be in a position now to where you can start asking some questions and start troubleshooting this.
I actually remember the story, so I'm not going to say anything
from now. Yes, and I've heard it too. Very similar to what I was troubleshooting this August when I was installing my friend's new router at their house, because I basically changed the guts and the heart and soul of the network. It's a very similar problem.
Well, if it was wireless, I'd be checking that you had the correct authentication information, for one thing.
Okay, that they gave, well, it was open authentication, so...
So we got on the wireless network. Murray, I think Murray's the only non-past student here at the past. Oh, Gary Jackson's there. Come on, Gary, what about a response?
Were you able to ping the hotel's gateway?
Well, that was one problem. I needed to find out what it was, okay? So, let's see. Was I able to ping it? No, I was not.
Did you ping the gateway?
No, negative. I was not able to do that.
That might be one way of actually getting close to guessing the gateway, if you could know the... If you could... Yeah.
We haven't got much response out of our students. Come on, guys, what about some ping and IP config and stuff?
Well, did you have DHCP on your laptop?
I did. Good one, though, Kylie.
That's what I thought.
But you're not asking me the results of some, you know, certain things. Come on, guys, this is your last class here.
Was the... FT used IP config, was it correct? The IP address, the, you know, subnet mask, the gateway, was that all correct?
Well, okay, let me tell you what the results were. To the best of my recollection, I had a default gateway of 192.168.0.1. I didn't have an IP address at that point. That's what I can remember about my IP config.
What about the hotel's default gateway? You would have to ask what theirs was, I guess.
Yeah, actually that was listed, and it was... something like 110 dot something. So Carl had read that to me, and so I knew that it was like 110 something.
I guess you had to change information on your computer then.
I guess I did, didn't I?
So what did we change, or then what did Jackie change on her computer? Because I think she'd been messing around with it a bit at home and was quite happy with her settings, and when she moved onto another network, it never worked until she had to go and do something.
You could do it through TCP/IP. You could give your computer a static, but DHCP should have worked, shouldn't it? Shouldn't it?
Well, yes and no. Okay, you're on the right track. You're in the right dialog box.
What did I say that my default gateway was?
192.168.0.1.
All right, was that the correct gateway for the hotel?
No.
No.
Bingo.
Clearly not. So what did I have to do to change the situation? Where did I have to go?
You had to go into the IP... I forgot what that area is called, but you had to change the default gateway to the hotel's gateway so you can connect, right?
Actually, what I did, guys, was that I right-clicked, you know, I went into my to network connections,
yeah,
and I right-clicked wireless, and I chose properties, and then I chose TCP/IP. And in the IP tab, there's a thing called default gateway, and what I actually ended up doing, folks, was removing any assignments. That allowed DHCP to work entirely, and it picked up what the default gateway was, etc.
Just check the radio button that says obtain an IP address and stuff automatically.
Yeah, automatically. Actually, I think I had to remove...
Yeah, you should remove it, and it grays out those boxes anyway where you would normally write that stuff in. And click OK, and away you go.
Yeah, it took off like a mad thing, so and I was able to connect. Only at 11... Mbps, though. It was pretty slow, actually.
It was
connecting my wireless.
Did DHCP work the same way? Would that have done it?
What's that, Carly?
Would doing a release renew on your DHCP have done it? You know, flushing it and and renewing it again?
No, because it was bolted down. See, what she'd done is she had...
the default gateway was evidently bolted down.
Yeah, it's like you should fill the three fields in, like IP, your own IP address, your subnet mask, and your default gateway. Now, because Jackie had been doing the discovery course as a student, probably she was in there messing around and left the setting there or something. So,
you know, I'm not sure if it was that or if it was just what Quest does normally or whatever, but anyway, it was filled in. Oh, you'd be surprised at what Quest does here. It's got a DNS-specific domain suffix and everything that it adds.
Mm, that should be all added in your router, though, shouldn't it?
Actually, it evidently funnels those down to the computer as well. I don't like that either.
Oh, so I might have to do some configuring on Monday night on my system. You better give me all the details.
10.4, actually, I might do some configuring on this router.
Mm. All right, so we should get on your network anyway. That would be good. Oh, well, there you go. So she just had to undo that and put it back to obtain an IP address automatically, and off it went.
Well, we've got 15 minutes left. Does anybody have any questions?
Do we do another scenario? We can do a chapter quiz, I suppose. What do you want, guys?
I don't know. This chapter quiz is kind of convoluted here, Elise.
Oh, I'll give the first question anyway, and if it gets too hard, we'll drop out. What do you reckon? Well, what's that, Kylie?
Yeah, up to you. Another scenario is cool. I don't mind. Whatever.
Well, I can bring up that worksheet and describe you the network if you want. It's up to anyone.
I'll do the first questions. A small office uses an ISR to connect to a cable modem for internet access. So we've got an ISR connected to a cable modem. The network administrator receives a call that an office computer cannot access external websites. The first thing he does is he pings the ISR. Which troubleshooting technique does this represent? Does it represent top-down, A, B, bottom-up, C, substitution, D, divide and conquer? So A is top-down, B is bottom-up, C is substitution, D is divide and conquer.
One more response.
Yep.
We've got three students on here. We've got two answers. All right, for those people answering D, you are correct. Divide and conquer.
All right, okay. Now, let's do this as a Y or an N, okay? The question is, select three items that should be documented after troubleshooting an internal web server crash. Three items that should be documented. Should this be documented? When the problem occurred, is that important to know?
Yep, people answering Y is correct. When the problem occurred, yep.
The dialogue with the user, is that important or not?
People answering no, I'd say so, yeah, because, it's sort of, we're talking about a server here, aren't we?
The configuration of all networking devices on the LAN at the time of the crash?
I don't know about that one.
Well...
It's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah, that
probably
is a tricky one.
Configuration of all devices on the... Well, it could be a rather large network, so maybe the answer is no.
I'd say no.
Yep. The configuration of all hosts on the LAN at the time of the crash is the next one. Yes or no?
All hosts. And this is a web server.
The people who got N are correct. Next possibility to change.
Steps that were identified. Steps that were performed to identify the cause of the problem.
Steps that were taken to identify the cause of the problem. Absolutely. You people answering yes, you are correct. Go ahead, Jay.
The other one was steps that were performed that failed to identify the cause of the problem. Yep. Right.
People answering why, you are correct. Next question.
A user calls the help desk to report a workstation problem. Which three questions would produce the most helpful information? Choose three. So again, it's a Y or no, Y or N. If you received an error message, what was it? Would that be helpful?
Yep, people are answering why, you are correct.
The next question is, were there any changes to your workstation recently?
People answering why, you are correct.
The other question is, do you have a warranty for your workstation?
Yep, not necessary. No is the
what version
answer.
Of operating system is running on your workstation? Would that be helpful?
People answering yes, you are correct.
Have you used a network monitoring tool on your workstation?
What was the original question?
It was helpful in troubleshooting.
Everyone's answered no to that. Have you used a network monitoring tool? Well, any piece of information is useful. Piece of information to be blunt.
Well, yeah, since we've already answered three.
Yeah, answer three. When did you last perform a backup? Yeah, well, it's...
Yeah, when did you last perform a backup?
Yeah.
Which command can be used to verify a connection between a host's? Is it A, ipconfig, B, ping, C, netstat, or D, nslookup. So A is ipconfig, B is ping, C is netstat, and D is nslookup to verify connectivity between two hosts.
People answering B, which is ping, you are correct.
Yep. Oh, boy. Okay. What we got is a matching question.
We can skip it if you want.
Okay. The utilities are ping, netstat, traceroute, ipconfig, and nslookup. So why don't we just write the first letter of the utility? So it would be like P for ping, N for netstat, T for traceroute, I for ipconfig, and N for nslookup. Okay? So the purpose.
We did N for nslookup and N for netstat. That would be confusing.
Oh. Then let's put D for like DNS lookup. Okay, so type D for DNS lookup.
Okay.
Yeah, NS lookup. Okay. Okay. So the purpose, the utility, it displays an IP settings on the host. What utility does that?
IP config. Yeah, correct.
Displays network connections.
Okay, the two people answering N for netstat, you are correct.
Test connections to other IP hosts. Yep.
P for ping, you are correct.
Displays route taken to destination.
Displays route to destination, that would be traceroute, yes.
Traceroute, yeah. Asks name server for info on destination domain. Yeah, yep.
Yep, DNS or NS lookup.
Okay, the following ask which three pieces of information are revealed by the IP config. So just type Y or N if this is a piece of information that's revealed by IP config. Physical address, the MAC address. Y'all go to your DOS prompt and do an IP config, and what you will see is the physical address of every
network
NIC
interface
that's connected to your computer.
So okay. People answering no is incorrect. So we want to say yes for that answer, didn't we?
We do. An IP address, is that revealed by the IP config?
Yep, an easy one. Everyone answering why? You are correct.
What about the DHCP server? That's right. What
people
about the DNS?
Well, correct.
Yeah.
Well, hang on. I think
kind
it
of indirectly.
Do a dash all, doesn't
wait,
it? Indirectly.
IP
config,
not IP config all.
Yes,
right.
If
this
you do an IP config dash all, you'll see, but without the dash all, you won't. Slash all,
right. What about the DNS server? Is that revealed?
And is correct.
Subnet mask?
And Y is correct, which you've already answered, because it reveals your subnet mask.
And default gateway?
And default gateway, answering yes for that, is correct.
Well, that's interesting. Hold on a second.
Got a problem?
All right, you know what? I lied. The IP config command does not reveal the physical address. The all does,
I
think.
I don't think so, yeah.
But
yeah, all right. The all
but
does.
Not
all right,
the,
there you go. I think you're right. I'm just used to doing slash all. Yeah. Yes, it does if you do the slash all. So some of those questions, if you use the slash all switch, will give you things like the physical address. So our apologies.
Interesting. So, guys, what you're going to have to do, well, and I don't know if they would ask this during the test or not, but what you're going to have to do is differentiate between what IP config reveals and what IP config slash all reveals. I myself never just use IP config, if you want to know the truth about it. I always use slash all. I just do. Well, guys,
we're
I guess it's like 2 minutes to four,
yeah,
so
we're not going to do the other
let's just
questions.
Let them go.
I totally agree.
Well, guys, we've enjoyed teaching you. Thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you for having us.
It's been a privilege working with you all. It really has, guys. And just a personal note, I've enjoyed it. But we do need a break, and we'll come back in some form next year. But we may or may not do other lectures as once-offs later in the year. We'll just have to see how things go. But this will be the last from us for a little while. But Jay, once again.
By the way, you guys, if you want to throw around anything, kick around any network walls when you know, Elise and Jackie are away, just get hold of me, because, yeah, if I can help at all, I will.
Thanks, Kylie. That's really
thank
lovely.
You, Kylie.
Yeah, I think there's no reason why she couldn't help. She's passed the course, and she's doing her instructor training for IT, so Kylie is really switched on there and knows a heap of stuff, and is a very good researcher and a very good communicator.
We'll try and, you know, do things like activating exams and all that stuff. Well, our holidays are here, but we'll try. We'll really try for you guys, because you shouldn't have to suffer, because we're having fun.
Tell you what, Jay, on a personal, a professional, and a technical an emotional and a spiritual level. Once again, it's been absolutely lovely working with you, and you are really such a joy to work with, and that's why I think, you know, we're
well, same with you, Elise, and I think we have commandeered the Discovery train into the final home stop. Hope that all have enjoyed the ride, and welcome to the destination, and enjoy your travels wherever they may take you, in Cavi land or computer land or IT land or even beyond IT. So good luck to everybody, and you know, we'll be around to help you guys. We're not abandoning you, though it may seem like that for the next 3 weeks. We aren't. And the course officially ends the last week in January, and we will be, you know, available to mark worksheets and stuff once Elise and I are done with our vacation.
3 sleeves to go.
Have a good one, everybody.
Catch you all later.
I enjoyed the class.
Thanks, Gary. And it's
We've
been
enjoyed
lovely
having every one of you.
Bye, folks.